This reminds me of an old song by the Mamas and the Papas, California Dreamin'. Stopping in a church on a cold winter's day. Y'all remember that one? It's good to be together tonight. Glad to see everybody. Those who've come to study God's Word, we're happy to be together on a cold winter's day, but in a warm building, and thankful for God's blessings today. We continue our study tonight in the life of Christ, and we'll be looking, as we have been, in the Galilean ministry. And following up with from our last class, which we studied a good number of the parables that Jesus taught, we'll be looking at some of the miracles that he performs just immediately after telling those parables. And the miracles of Christ, of course, we've already seen him perform very many. And of course, these were designed to bring people to belief in him. And the ones we're going to study tonight, as I thought about it, really deal with some of our greatest human fears and problems. We'll talk about the fear of a storm. Anybody afraid of storms? I think with living in North Alabama, we're taught to be afraid of storms, at least, and the sirens and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, think about the storms that we face in life. An incurable disease, like this woman with issue of blood is going to have, death itself, demon possession, blindness. These are the miracles we're going to look at tonight. And it really demonstrates to us, brings us to believe in Christ as the one who has the power to deal with problems that are insurmountable to us. And that ought to create faith and trust in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. So that's where we're going in tonight's lesson, and I invite your attention to the Gospel of Mark. We'll be focusing on the Gospel of Mark. Most of this is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but Mark's account is a little more organized and succinct, so I'll spend most of the time in Mark, and we'll be looking starting in Mark chapter 4, verse 35, after Mark's account of the parables. Now, Mark and Luke have this coming right after Jesus telling the parables. Matthew has it out of order a little bit, but I think Matthew collects the parables together in chapter 13 without so much respect to the chronology of it. He collects all of them together in chapter 13. In any case, on the same day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." And when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats also with him. So they're crossing the Sea of Galilee, as they've done so many times. Jesus gets in the little boat, and as they sailed, he fell asleep, and a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water. That's Luke's account of it. We'll pick up in Mark chapter 4, in verse 37. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. They awoke him and said, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" He arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The disciples are terrified of the storm. They've got one who has performed amazing miracles in their presence. They have a lot of confidence, probably, that he could do something about this, but nonetheless, they're fearful of the storm, and Jesus is asleep during this. They rouse him, "Don't you care that we're perishing?" And I think he showing a lot of calmness, knowing that he is, whether he's asleep or awake, in control of the situation, simply says to the wind and the sea, "Peace, be still." And it becomes still. This, I remember as a child. Do you remember learning this as a child, this account, when you were little? I think of all of Jesus' miracles, this maybe had the biggest impression on me. I don't know why that is. You would think raising somebody from the dead, but when you're a kid, you don't have a good concept of death and sickness and those kinds of things. I don't know why, but as a little child, I can distinctly remember he stopped the wind. He stopped the storm. with just his words. The power of the word of Christ, of course, created the world. His word is all-powerful, and it certainly can control the elements. This is what you would expect of the Son of God, that he could do this. But he's trying to teach the disciples a lesson on faith, not just a lesson about trusting him and believing him, but really having full faith in him, much more than they had demonstrated here on this occasion. So in one account, he asked them, "Where is your faith?" In Mark's account, it is, "O ye of little faith," and or "How is it that you have no faith?" Matthew's account is, "O you of little faith." And so you take all of that together, he's questioning the depth of their faith. And they respond in such a way that indicates that their faith was being increased. Who can this be? We have underestimated. How could that be that they underestimated him? They'd seen him already raise a dead person. They'd seen a whole bunch of miracles. They've been following him now for probably a year and a half or so or more. And who can this be? They had even still underestimated who Jesus is. And they wouldn't really fully understand who Jesus is, I'm sure, until after the resurrection. But nonetheless, yeah, at least four of them were fishermen, probably Philip as well, probably five. And many of them had been on the sea quite a bit, obviously. They knew what a storm was. They knew the danger of it. They dealt with that all of their lives. This was obviously an exceptional storm, and to just calm it with words is amazing. Just a little bit about the Sea of Galilee to help you picture this. I don't know how much picturing of it we need, but Sea of Galilee is this pear-shaped lake if you looked at it from outer space. The length is about 13 miles from north to south, and it's about 8 miles wide, the depth of 157 feet. The lake is 686 feet below sea level. You realize this is the Rift Valley that flows, that the Jordan follows from the headwaters of the Jordan through the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, which is over 1,000 feet below sea level. And this is the lowest place on earth that you can be on earth and still be on earth. Okay? It's the lowest place below sea level. So that is this area, and of course the Dead Sea below. But the vertical gain between the Sea of Galilee and the top of Mount Arbel is 1,280 feet. That's quite a bit of distance, and it helps create some of the wind currents that can occur in this area. This is a picture that I took when I was on the Sea of Galilee. It was a relatively calm day, and that's kind of normal, I think, for how things are there, but it's not how it is all the time. This is almost from the same place, looking at Mount Arbel, with waves crashing on the shore that looks like you're on the north shore of Oahu or something, about ready to, do the surfboarding and things they do there. Just amazing type waves. And if you've ever been on a lake or in the sea when a storm came up, it's frightening. This would be truly terrifying. Something like that. And they do have these kinds of storms, even still today, occasionally on the Sea of Galilee. This was a tornado that came down on the lake in 2006. One of the residents said, "Believe me, it was like a tsunami." I don't think he knew what a tsunami was. But he says, "I thought Hurricane Katrina had come to Israel." So those kinds of things happened there, and this was that kind of experience. Whether the storm was caused supernaturally or not, I have no reason to think that it was. It was stopped supernaturally by a word from the Son of God. Very impressive, I think. Very, very impressive Jesus is on this occasion. Well, they cross over the sea, and they come to an area, depending on which translation and which of the Gospels you're looking at, it could be the area of the Gerasenes or the Gadarenes or the Gergesenes. There's some trouble with deciphering which word it is there in that place. But we pick up in Mark chapter 5 then. Follow with me. in verse 1, they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes, is what the New King James says there. Other texts, as I said, have another word, and there's a Greek problem as well. In any case, in verse 2, when he come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, neither could anyone tame him. Here's a man who is frightful, would be frightening to look at, frightening to be around, just frightening, period, when you think about how awful demon possession was. A devil, a demon taking a hold of somebody's being. He's dwelling in the tombs, and this is, you know, what you think of in some kind of Hollywood horror movie or something. You've got this mad, demon-possessed person living among in a cemetery, in essence. It's as creepy as it could be, right? And then somebody that you can't control, you can't bind him, you chain him and you shackle him, and he breaks the chains and he breaks the shackles. So he's got beyond normal strength, at least beyond normal determination to do that. You can't control him in any way. And night and day, he's described as being in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out, cutting himself, doing self-harm. So just a horrible situation that this man was in, horrible existence that he was experiencing, and one that would be terrifying to most people to interact with. And obviously it was. People stayed away from him and were afraid of him. Jesus is going to cast out this demon. We pick up in verse 6. He sees Jesus from afar, and he ran and worshiped him. Now you got to remember, the demons are in control of this man, and they're the ones who would cause him to run and worship Jesus. Why would they do that? Why would demons worship Jesus? Exactly. We've seen this before a couple of times already, right? So the demons and the people that they're possessing, they recognize who Jesus is, and you know, they may not, it's like somebody who's very, very powerful. They're not necessarily on your side, but you have to respect them. And Jesus, that would be especially true of. So they are worshiping him. They address him as Jesus, Son of the Most High God. And verse 7, the man says, I implore you by God that you do not torment me. So the man, the demons, using his voice, asking for mercy. He said, come out of the man, unclean spirit. And he asked him, what is your name? And he answered, saying, my name is Legion, for we are many. So it's not just one demon that's possessing this person, but multitude of demons are possessing him and have completely overwhelmed his being from this account. But he begged Jesus in verse 10 that he would not send him out of the country. Now, different translations and also different gospels have different wording of this. Luke's account says that he begs Jesus not to torment him or send him into the abyss. And I want to talk a little bit about that. What specifically was said here was probably a combination of all of that. I find in studying the Gospels, when there's a variation in the accounts, it's typically because one of the Gospel writers or the other is not giving everything that was said. And if you put it all together, you can get a whole concept of everything that was said. In any case, the idea of the abyss is interesting to me. The word there in Luke's account, we get our word abyss out of it. Abyssus is the word. We get our word abyss from that. And it really just means a bottomless pit. In fact, it's translated bottomless pit several times in the book of Revelation. You might remember in the seven trumpets in the fifth trumpet in Revelation 9, there was a bottomless pit that these horrible locusts came out of, and there was a ruler over the bottomless pit called Abaddon or Apollyon that was this horrible being that inflicted pain on those that God was cursing. Satan himself in Revelation 20 is cast into the bottomless pit. Revelation 20 verses 1 through 3, John sees an angel coming down with the key to the bottomless pit and a chain, and he binds Satan and he casts him into the bottomless pit for 1,000 years. So that bottomless pit, then the abyss, as it's translated in Luke, seems to be a really unpleasant place of confinement and or punishment for demons and for evil beings. That's about all I can conclude from the way it's used in the New Testament. Not a nice place whatsoever. Horrible place, a place made for the confinement of evil beings. So these beings, these demons, didn't want to go there. They didn't want to leave the area that they were in, is the thing that they were asking of Jesus. So we go back to the text, and verse 11 says, there was a large herd of swine that was feeding there near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, send us into the swine that we may enter them. At once Jesus gave them permission. What's unusual about that? I mean, as if any of this was usual. What's interesting, maybe, about how Jesus is treating the demons here? He's merciful to the demons. I mean, he could have done anything he wanted to, right? He's the Son of God. Could have sent them to outer space as far as that goes, or to the bottomless pit, or out of the country, or wherever. They, as demons, his enemies, ask for mercy, and he gives them the mercy that they ask for. One of the things that we probably don't appreciate about God the Father and God the Son enough is their tremendous sense of justice and fairness, coupled with a mercy for everybody, and nobody really deserves mercy. That's the definition of mercy, right? It's kindness that you don't deserve. That's what mercy is all about. And Jesus is all merciful. He's full of mercy, even as his Heavenly Father is. And that's pretty impressive. So as the account continues, the demons, unclean spirits, they leave the man, they enter the swine. There are about 2,000 of these swine. The herd runs violently down the steep place into the sea, and they drown in the sea. The ones who fed the swine are fleeing in terror. Jesus' power over demons really proves, doesn't it, his identity as God's Son. He had said in an earlier lesson, we noticed, a lesson before last, he told the scribes and Pharisees, you know, you can't enter a strong man's house unless you bind the strong man. And here, Jesus is binding the strong man over and over again by controlling these demons, by telling them where to go, what they can do and what they can't do. There's a promise that's made in the book of Zechariah in the Old Testament, a prophecy that when the Son of David would come, there would be a fountain opened for the forgiveness of sins, for uncleanness. And the unclean spirit would pass out of the land. That's part of what would be accomplished in the Messiah's kingdom. And of course, Jesus as the Son of David, the Messiah, is accomplishing exactly that. The place where this occurred is not certain geographically. We know what side of the Sea of Galilee it's on. Of course, we can look up and down the east side of the Sea of Galilee and see some likely places. This is probably the most likely place. This is in an area close to what is modern Kersa, K-E-R-S-A, and it's believed that this is the same place as Gergesa in the New Testament. So I don't know if you can tell how steep this hill is, but it's, you know, those are really big trees down there at the bottom. It's not quite a cliff, but it is a really steep embankment. You can sort of picture a bunch of pigs getting head of steam going up and just running themselves down into the sea from that point. So it could well have been in this area. At least that would fit both the basic location and the terrain of the story. Well, what happens then is that the swineherders, who are probably Gentiles, why would I say that? Yeah, Jews don't have anything to do with swine, with pigs. They're unclean animals, so they wouldn't be hurting them. Almost certainly Gentiles then. They flee, and they tell of the event in the city and in the country. So they run in terror and tell everybody they can tell about what happened. And the people hear it and come out to see what had occurred. They came to Jesus in verse 15. And they see the one who had been demon-possessed, had the legion. He's sitting now clothed and in his right mind. And they're all the more afraid. They wonder who in the world could control or what happened here to this person. Those who saw it told them how it happened to him who'd been demon-possessed and about the swine. So they would be very impressed, obviously, with the power of Christ, with what he'd been able to accomplish. The loss of swine may have been a great concern to many of them. That was, you know, a lot of Christmas hams going into the water there, I suppose. They would have been very concerned about that, among other things. And so what do? They plead with Jesus to leave the country. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have a little trouble understanding that completely. I mean, you've got this terrifying guy that Jesus has helped out, got him calmed down, and they're more concerned, I think, about the overwhelming power that Jesus possesses and what he was able to do on this occasion than they are about having their problem of the demon-possessed man solved. Yeah, I think that's it exactly, Freddie, that they're very afraid of what he could do, period, let alone what he might could do to them had he so chosen, of course, and that wouldn't be Jesus' nature at all, but they didn't know that. So they plead for him to depart the region. He gets into the boat, but the person who'd been demon-possessed, who'd had the legion, begged him to come, that he could come with Jesus. He wants to accompany him. So you have some people run away, you have other people that want Jesus to go away, and you have the guy that has the demons cast out of him, he wants to go with Jesus. So you see the different reactions to the power of Jesus, and you have different reactions to the power of Jesus today, don't you? You have people, getting back to what Freddie said, you think a lot of people today are really afraid of the power of Jesus, the justice of Jesus, and the mercy of Jesus, and they run away from him. They don't want him in their land, they don't want him in their lives, because of his power. I think a lot of people today are frankly afraid of who Jesus is. These people were, but there was a man who was healed who wasn't, and he wanted to be with Jesus. But Jesus didn't permit it. He said, go home to your friends, tell them what great things the Lord has done for you, how he's had compassion on you. He tells the man to go home, and the man then in verse 20 departs and begins to proclaim in the Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled. So here's a man who has a living story to tell of how Jesus had completely changed his life, given him back his life after this horrible demon possession. The Decapolis has been mentioned before, and I'll just share this with you about the region just generally. It's a fairly large region on the eastern side of the Jordan River. It's modern-day Jordan. These are the 10 cities. I think Damascus is counted as one of them, although it's far up to the north in Syria. These are the main cities of the Decapolis here. These are all Greco-Roman cities that were built to spread Greco-Roman culture. And so they would be, if you had Greeks and Romans living in the area, they would be populated largely by Greeks and Romans, although there are probably a few Jews in some of them, you would think, people of Israel interspersing occasionally. All of that. Mark is the only gospel writer to mention this region by name, and he, of course, is the gospel writer who is writing. It seems, if you analyze his writing and the way he makes his appeal concerning Jesus, he appears to be writing to Romans more than any other group. And that would make sense that he would talk about Jesus being spread in this area and the work that Jesus did in this area. This is one of the cities of the Decapolis, the ruins of it. This is Scythopolis. You can see the colonnades here. It's just really some amazing structures. This is, the people are very small there. This is some really large monumental structures. This is the theater at Scythopolis, just very beautiful. You can see the colonnades back in here. Would have been something to behold back in the day of Jesus, but the man may have visited Scythopolis if he went through all the Decapolis telling about Jesus. Others also went through the Decapolis, some of Jesus' disciples telling about Jesus, and Jesus himself visited the area at one point, it said. So this is a place where a lot of things were learned about Jesus, and people came to believe in him through events like the one we just studied. All right, let's go on in Mark chapter 5, and we'll look at verse 21. Jesus crossed over again in the boat, so he's come back to the western shore, probably around Capernaum, where he's spent so much time already. And a lot of people are following him. A ruler of the synagogue comes, Jairus by name, and he sees Jesus. He falls at his feet, and he begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come, lay your hands on her that she may be healed, and she will live." So Jesus went to him. A great multitude followed and thronged. So Jesus is going with the ruler of the synagogue to heal his daughter. But as he's going, there's a woman in the crowd who suffered from an issue of blood. She'd had it for 12 years. The text tells us in verse 26, she'd suffered many things from many physicians. She'd spent all that she had, was no better, but rather grew worse. Even today with modern medicine, there are a lot of people that could say that about their malady, that they've got some disease, some sickness, some problem, and they've been to every doctor in the country, they've spent all the money they've got, and they're still not any better. You probably know people like that. There may be people sitting in this room like that. That's even with modern medicine. But you think, back in this day and time, here's a woman, she's got this problem, and it's really ruining her life, especially as a Jew. What would be the problem if you had an issue of blood 24/7, 7 days a week, all year long? What's a problem for a woman in Jewish society? She's unclean. Yeah, she couldn't really participate in society, in religious services, in anything. She's virtually, it's almost like having leprosy. You're constantly unclean. Nobody would want to be around you. You couldn't engage in public activities, on and on and on. So her life is a horrible mess at this point. And she's unclean. She suffered. She spent all of her money. She reaches out and touches the hem of Jesus' garment as he passes by, believing that she could be healed. And she is. It's an amazing thing. Of course, I'm satisfied that Jesus was aware what is going on, even though he asked, "Who touched my clothes?" Whether that's the case or not. But he knew that power was gone out from him, it says in verse 30. She had been healed of her affliction in verse 29. His disciples say, "Well, everybody's thronging you. You've got this multitude of people around you touching you. What do you mean, who touched me?" And he looks around and he sees her who'd done this thing. The woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. So she comes and basically admits what she's done, why she did it, and Jesus responds to that by saying in verse 34, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Be healed of your affliction." Jesus really just almost nonchalantly, or something even less than that, healing a woman who couldn't get any help from any human being anywhere with everything she had to give. And yet Jesus, you know, you might say almost accidentally, and it wasn't, but the woman touches his garment and receives complete healing just by that, just by that, when she couldn't get any help from anybody else anywhere. That's a wonderful story that helps us understand the power of Jesus to help us out in the human condition. Well, yeah, that's what she said. That shows a tremendous amount of faith, the kind of faith that we need to have in Jesus to help us with our problems as well. Right. Tony's mentioning the fact that she reached out and touched Jesus, even the hem of his garment, when she's unclean. That's probably a no-no in Jewish society. And she doesn't know how Jesus would react to that. That's probably one of the reasons she's fearful and trembling as she presents herself. She doesn't know how that might be taken. But she knows what Jesus did and what he was capable of doing, and her faith is showing. Well, we continue on and look at what happens with Jairus' daughter now. Jesus is still speaking. People come from his house and they say, you know, don't trouble the teacher. Your daughter has died. And Jesus tells him in verse 36, do not be afraid, only believe. So we just had this great example of somebody being healed by their faith. Now Jesus is telling Jairus, you have faith too. Don't be afraid. You just believe. And so this is a test now of his faith, of his trusting Jesus. Jesus doesn't permit anyone but Peter, James, and John to enter the house with him when he gets there. He proclaims, the child is not dead, but sleeping. And we've noticed this about Jesus before. When he heals people, when he raises people from the dead, it's just like he's waking somebody up from sleep. It's no more to him than that. He's so powerful. He's infused with the power of God, and he is himself life as he's presented to us. He is the life. He's the giver of life. And so he's not, you know, going through all these gyrations or concerns or anything like that. He's got all of this well within his realm of ability. The child is not dead but sleeping. Jesus takes the child by the hand and says, little girl, I say to you, arise. That's in verse 41. Talitha kumi, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl gets up and walks. She's 12 years old, so she's called a little girl, but she's not so little that she can't walk. That's the point of that. She's 12 years old. And people were greatly amazed. Jesus commands them not to tell anybody about the miracle. If it becomes widely known about any of the miracles that Jesus can perform, of course, then everybody's going to be coming, and that's what has happened already. The incidents of him raising people from the dead don't seem to be as frequent as some of the other miracles, and you might imagine why that would be the case. Everybody would want their dead loved one to be raised, and so things like this were especially kept quiet, I think, especially at this point in his ministry. But in any case, she's raised from the dead. And then in this same time frame, we'll go over to Matthew's gospel quickly, and we'll notice one other miracle that occurs, Jesus healing two blind men. He healed a lot of blind people. We've seen one or two already. He heals another one in John chapter 9. He heals Bartimaeus on the road to Jericho as he enters, heading to Jerusalem before the crucifixion. So number of blind people are healed by Jesus. In Matthew 9 and verse 27, and this has this right after the casting out of the man with the legion of demons. Jesus departed from there, and two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, "Son of David, have mercy on us." What's the significance of Jesus being called Son of David? What is being acknowledged there? His lineage. Why is that? Why is his lineage important? Who is going to come from the lineage of David? The Christ. I believe anytime Jesus is called the Son of David, it's an acknowledgement that he's the Messiah. That's not something you would just, how would you even know what somebody's lineage was, and why would that be important unless it was that was the lineage of the Messiah as prophesied in the Old Testament. So when he's called the Son of David, it's necessarily implied, I think, that he's being acknowledged as the Messiah. These two men calling out to him as the Son of David, I think, are showing faith in him as the Messiah just by calling him that. When they come into the house, the blind man came to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I'm able to do this?" And he said to them, "Yes, Lord." So you see Jesus in these last three miracles, this one and the two before, focusing on faith, people believing in him. And that's going to be the crux of the matter as he performs these miracles. When they say yes, that they do believe that he can do this, he touches their eyes and he says, "According to your faith, let it be to you." So again, faith is the prime thing that Jesus is wanting to elicit in these miracles. Their eyes were open, they see, and Jesus warns them that they let nobody know it. But they spread the news anyway. As yeah, Jesus is making these miracles dependent on people's faith. He has the power either way, but he's not every time, but much of the time he's making that dependent on people's faith. And the connection between the miracle and the faith, I think we don't need to lose that. It's the main thing. Jesus' power is available to those who believe in him. You get that? Even today, Jesus' power is available to those who believe in him. I don't believe in modern day miracles, supernatural events entering our lives. I think there was a purpose for these. There's not that purpose anymore. But his power for us today, which is still really beyond, you know, anything that human beings can do, both in our spiritual, emotional, and physical lives, Jesus' power is tapped into by faith still today. Yeah. Right. So the faith has to be joined with action. Or if it's not worth anything, if it's not, it's dead, as James says in James 2. Great point, Chris. All right, we'll leave it there and continue on, Lord willing, Sunday morning.